Today's speaker is Sir Crispin Tickell. He is director of the Policy Foresight Programme at the James Martin Institute for Science and Civilization. I'm actually not going to say too much about his biography because, as you can see, he's done an awful lot, and all in relation mainly to climate change, and to say that he was there before the rest of us is an understatement. His book, Climate Change and World Affairs, was first published in 1977. So he is ahead of us by far, and he is a Knight of the Grand Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George, and Knight Commander of the Royal Victorian Order. He has had a distinguished... All right. Great. He has had a distinguished diplomatic career, ambassador to Mexico, chef de cabinet of the President of the European Commission, permanent secretary of the ODA, as it used to be, now it's DFID, of course, permanent representative at the United Nations, and I could go on, but I promised Sir Crispin I won't. I'm going to hand over to him and ask him if he will deliver his words, and then it's over to Frank Field. So without further ado, Sir Crispin.
Well, first, thank you for asking me. I can't help thinking somebody's trodden on something. But maybe let me now just pick up. If we all have to evacuate into the street, we'll know where it was, when it was that it happened. The title of the talk we agreed upon was The Impact of Climate Change on Global Security and World Affairs. Well, it's a very big subject, and many of you could contribute as much as I could to this subject, but I'm now going to take you on a kind of rapid run through the thing in the hope that you will indeed ask some difficult questions, because the more difficult the question, the more interesting it is to try and answer it. First, security is, of course, an overworked word. It can be global security, it can be national security, and individual security. One definition that is quite useful is the assurance people have that they will continue to enjoy those things that are most important to their survival and well-being. And this at least underlines the somewhat subjective character of security and the way it differs according to different circumstances. Fears about environmental catastrophe have in some respects replaced fears that people used to have about the dangers of nuclear war and an east-west conflict which would destroy everything. And I think that the trouble is, in both cases, is that it induces a kind of feeling of helplessness, both on the part of individuals and on the part of institutions. Now, by contrast, military authorities of any kind cannot afford to be too romantic about it, or indeed to be too intimidated. They've got to work out what to do. And it's quite interesting how much military authorities in different countries have already focused on the implications of climate change. There have been papers that I've seen recently written by the Pentagon and by the Ministry of Defense, and incorporated to some degree into their strategic planning. I won't say that those august bodies actually gave me copies of their papers, but as in the age of leaks, one can learn a lot. Well, I'll begin. I don't want to go into this too much because you must be exhausted with hearing about climate change, but let me just quickly run through the main aspects of climate change. A word that I prefer to avoid using, if I can, I prefer to use the word climate destabilization. Last year, the government's chief scientific advisor, Sir David King, said that climate change was a threat to society bigger than terrorism. In a few words, the problem relates primarily but not exclusively to the build-up of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which are now at their highest level for 650,000 years. And if things continue as they are, we will be back in conditions not dissimilar from those 125,000 years ago, when conditions in the Earth were very different from those today. In such an event, you'd have to redo all the geography books, redraw the sea and the sea levels, redraw the cities, and so on and so forth. So we're now standing on a path which is not unlike what happened 125,000 years ago. And all this, of course, has been well brought out in the successive reports of the three working groups of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, with Al Gore, as you've just been reminded, won the Nobel Peace Prize last week. The implications for security, of course, were thereby very well brought out. We don't have to agree with every word with what is in the Intergovernmental Panel reports, nor do we have to agree with everything that Al Gore said, but I don't think anyone has challenged the broad conclusions of either. Well, of course, there is a serious dispute, and every now and again you find that it comes out in the newspapers or elsewhere, but it relates primarily to the distinction between natural change and human-driven change. Natural change is happening all the time, and we're now much better aware than we were in the past of the fluctuations of the past. We all live in that little patch of time, just about 12,000 years long, which is nothing in geological terms. We live in that little patch of time that has been warm since the last recession of the glaciers. If you look back, you can see there have been periods when it's been much warmer than this, and also periods that have been much colder than this. But you have these little fluctuations that are happening all the time. And there are certain points to watch, little sort of indication points of where things are going, of what is going on. One is the state of the Amazonian rainforest, which I should say had terrible droughts in the last couple of years. One would be the direction of the ocean currents, particularly in the North Atlantic. Another would be the release of methane from beneath the tundra and the ocean bed. Then the pattern of the Indian monsoon, a very critical factor, and the state of the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets and sea ice. Now, when you look at those things, you can't avoid the conclusion that change is taking place at an accelerating rate. And this is human-driven. And that is perhaps the central and most important message of these scientific reports to which I referred. The results for society are becoming clearer every day and could become more so with a rich variety of positive feedbacks. In a few words, these results include changes in weather everywhere, with a different distribution of rainfall and drought, and more extreme events like storms and floods, more melting of the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets. I went up to have a look myself last year at what was happening in the Arctic, and a couple of years before that I went down to Antarctica to see that too. Increasing sea level rise, it's going up at the moment at about 2 millimeters a year and going up and accelerating. Acidification of some upper layers of the ocean, which changes the biological content of the upper layers of the oceans worldwide, and changes in ecosystems generally, including insects and microorganisms. In other words, there's a huge pattern of change taking place. But in recording these main events, I should mention that there are, of course, many uncertainties, and those uncertainties may be becoming less important, and people are trying to narrow them. Nonetheless, there are many uncertainties. You have what are called tipping points between one climate regime and another. It's a very important concept because in the past, the change is not gradual as like a line on a graph. It goes in little stabs and movements like this, up and down and changing quite quickly. And you don't quite know what's going to happen. A major ecosystem change will completely change the character of the other living organisms all around us. And likewise, the storms and the hurricanes and the rest with it. And then, as I say, the other big uncertainty is the possible range of dislocations of weather patterns worldwide. And there was a recent paper written by the European Commission which brought together these points very well. And increasingly, its predictions for some of the effects in Europe are exactly opposite to those made by the Pentagon. So you paid your money and you take your choice. In any case, climate change has to be linked to directly or indirectly with the other great issues of our time. Climate change is not a big problem by itself. It is linked to all these other points. Above all, human population growth and the resulting patterns of migration, whether for environmental or political reasons, land degradation, resource depletion, waste accumulation and deforestation with manifest effects on agriculture and the supply of food, pollution and supply of water, both fresh and salt, and the prospects of sea level rise affecting many of the world's major cities, destruction of biodiversity, or that's a code word for the other living organisms, large and small, on which humans wholly depend. I think sometimes people forget the degree to which we do depend. We couldn't digest, we couldn't breathe without the help of the bacteria inside us, and their good health is our good health. Then you've got, of course, human health in all its aspects and control of possible pandemics. The effects of a switch to non-fossil fuel sources in energy, in particular biofuels and feedstocks, a very big subject, again, much in controversy at the moment. The human propensity to use violence, big or small, to settle disputes, a very important and disagreeable reminder of what we're like. Now, we also have to reckon with the consequences of possible mistakes in technology. There was a near miss in the 1960s, to which most people, I think, have now forgotten, over the development of technologies which would have done still more damage than chlorofluorocarbons to the ozone layer, which, of course, reduces the impact of certain wavelengths of ultraviolet light on humans and other forms of life. Innovation in technology is very important, but please don't think that technology is ever going to produce the answers. Some in the United States have a habit of thinking so, not least the president, but in my view, it is simply wishful thinking. Now, work on the impacts of climate change inevitably needs to take account of these other issues in which climate is intertwined. First, some history. It's always useful to look back and see what's happened in the past. I don't know whether you've seen, any of you, Jared Diamond's book called Collapse, in which he examines why societies, as he calls it, choose to survive or to fail. But the points he makes in that book, for example, about the degradation of Rwanda and the genocide of much of its population, was due to a lethal mix of overpopulation, deterioration of soils, and recurrent droughts. And the same can also be said of current events in Darfur. Themselves precipitated in part by drought, in turn precipitated by changes in the Indian monsoon, in turn precipitated by ocean warming. And in the long past, the collapse of the civilizations of the Indus Valley and of the cultures in pre-Columbian Mexico were all caused by a comparable mix of circumstances. Now, all complicated societies like ours are vulnerable, especially those led by cities, where about half the human species now lives. They can be likened to organisms drawing in food, materials, energy, and water, and emitting wastes. Once supplies are cut off, they and their apparatus of institutions can easily become destabilized. In this regard, the supply of energy from whatever source is crucial. Europe and the United States are both very vulnerable in that respect. For more rural societies dependent on one or two crops, there are even more direct threats to health and well-being. Then, as I said before, there's depletion of resources, including consumption of fossil water, from aquifers, something which is very marked at the moment in China. Overcultivation and deforestation, again, can be linked to changes in rainfall and a lively source of conflict. Even opening up new resources is not always benign. There are already burgeoning disputes between Russia, the United States, Canada, and possibly other countries over ownership of the land underlying the North Pole and navigation rights over the Northwest Passage. Now, reactions to change, of course, are various. There can be the famous defensive reactions, which can lead to the building of virtual fortresses around relatively rich countries to keep out intruders and protect resources. The same goes for relatively rich communities within generally poor countries. And I expect that most of you have seen examples of that, whether in California or indeed in Bangladesh. But walls of this kind are never effective for long. The Israelis would be no more capable of keeping out the Palestinians than the Americans of keeping out Mexicans and others from Central America. So those are the kind of defensive reactions. Then you come to the offensive reactions, particularly to countries worst hit by change, including invasion by others, movement of refugees, ethnic rivalries, and terrorist or guerrilla actions against rich countries. We forget that globalization cuts both ways. In the recent Pentagon paper, some possible scenarios were explored for the years 20, 2010 to 2020 and 2020 to 2030. They included large movements of population, driven north or south by changes in climate, conflict over water and other essential resources, and competition for fuel resources, whether in Europe, Asia, or the Americas. Of course, in the past, when human numbers were small, people could and did move as circumstances changed. But we are no longer hunter-gatherers. And a chilling conclusion of the Pentagon paper was that the results of climate change, and I quote, could be a significant drop in the carrying capacity of the Earth's environment. And then inequities between countries, as between communities, may become even less tolerable than today, and a potent source of conflict. In well-favored countries, climate change may be largely a problem of adaptation, but for poor ones, it is a matter of survival. For example, millions of people could be uprooted in Bangladesh, the Sahel, and parts of India and China. Half the world's population depends directly on local renewable resources for day-to-day well-being. It's a problem which I think people tend to minimize, but I've seen for myself occasions when globalization means that for the first time ever, people actually understand what is happening in poor countries, and they can witness for themselves how rich countries live. I remember once being in Amazonia, and the boat was going downstream, a rather luxurious boat, and up the other way came some local people paddling their canoes, and one couldn't help thinking, well, that's them and this is us. And then from the canoe, I heard a transistor radio broadcasting the latest information. So we no longer live in a world in which there are compartments. This is globalization in one of its aspects. And then, of course, there is the current redistribution of power and wealth means a redistribution of soft as well as hard power. Hard power being military power, soft power being the force of moral influence. The primacy enjoyed by the early industrial countries and now the United States in Europe is unlikely to last much longer. I go to China every year, and I've been for the last 15 years, and I do assure you that things are changing very fast. The implications for defense policy and all these factors go far and wide, from protection of key facilities to global humanitarian actions. Well, taking effective action to cope with this disparate collection of problems, some global and some national, and some individual, will require, whether we like it or not, a new international framework, or at least a substantial adaptation of the existing framework. I think we all have to recognize the porous character of sovereignty, seen in the declining power of nation states, and to learn to think more globally. First is the UN Security Council, whose fundamental task is the preservation of peace and security, and that could be called upon to cope with new but unfamiliar threats to security. As you probably know, Margaret Beckett, then Foreign Secretary, raised the security implications of climate change in the Security Council in April, and some other members welcomed the ensuing debate on the subject, others felt extremely uncomfortable. Many years ago, I also raised the issue in the Security Council with a conspicuous lack of success. The implications go far and wide and could involve a substantial increase in the responsibilities of the Council. But obviously, some sort of international organization, whether the Security Council or something else, will be required to establish, to regulate, to monitor, and dare I say it, to enforce any global treaty to reduce carbon emissions. The security implications are obvious. And here are some questions which we have to ask. Should there be a permanent inspectorate and or a permanent peacekeeping force with powers of intervention across frontiers? Should there be some connection with the Central Criminal Court, itself a subject of considerable controversy? Should there be measures to cope with free riders and other offenders, possibly through sanctions, although we all know sanctions are less than perfect as a means of coercion? We could certainly try and build on the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change of 1992 and on whatever may be agreed at Bali in December, in the forthcoming meetings in December. A more ambitious idea would be something which I've long favored, which is the creation of a World Environmental Organization to be the partner of the World Trade Organization and which would bring together under its umbrella all the existing environmental bodies and agreements, and thereby cut out a lot of waste and duplication and lack of proper direction. And I may add that it would be no enemy to the World Trade Organization. Indeed, one of the recent directors of the World Trade Organization strongly favoured this idea himself. Now, none of this will be easy. Looking ahead at the prospects of security, we seem to be in for a bumpy ride. Violence within and between communities and between nation states could well increase. Global arrangements are always fraught with difficulties. There have already been disheartening experiences, for example, over implementation of the law of the sea. Attitudes towards climate change are changing, even in the United States, but few can confidently predict progress in the near future. Another little problem has to be remembered. We will certainly need better understanding of the environmental consequences of military action on a national as well as a global scale. Should military authorities be subject to scrutiny for what they now do, usually with scant regard for the environment, allegedly in each country's national interest? Wars and conflicts have enormous implications for the environment, as recent history well demonstrates. As they've said in the classical language, quis custodiet custodiis, who looks after those who are doing the looking after? Well, I conclude, major change usually requires three factors. One factor is leadership from above, in which some political leader or someone else takes the initiative and is able to persuade others of the need for action. And here I do recall Margaret Thatcher with her speeches on climate change in the 1980s. The second factor is pressure from below in the form of non-governmental and community organizations of all kinds. And it's quite interesting to see that happening to some degree at the moment with the non-governmental organizations, with members of parliament who are currently examining a climate change bill and so on. And the third factor is what I call benign catastrophes, where cause and effect can be clearly identified and the appropriate lessons learnt. There was an occasion when I was in China in 1998 when, on behalf of the foreigners in the body I belonged to, expressed condolences to the Chinese government on the loss of life in the Yangtze floods of that year. And I was interrupted by the Prime Minister of China, Zhu Rongji, at that time, and he said more or less, "Look, thanks for your condolences, but we Chinese were substantially to blame for what happened. We had cut down the trees, we had diverted the rivers, we had filled in the lakes, and we had destroyed the topsoils. So when the floods came, as they always come, then there was a disaster." It's quite interesting, incidentally, in that regard to note that there was always skepticism in China about the Three Gorges project and the Three Gorges Dam, but that is now coming out into the open for the first time. Now, most important, of course, is to go for the true and underlying causes of conflict, understand what is at stake for all concerned, and try to diminish and adapt to the consequences. But I did have to remind you, old Adam and old Eve are still with us, competitive, docile, peaceful, violent, creative, wasteful, various and restless, now as in the future. Thank you.